Welcome to part two of the Guardian Ashes Weekly, brought to you by Qantas, the spirit of Australia. Can someone tell me, colour aside, because I'm across that, what is different about the pink ball? I'll go to you, Jeff.
Well, aside from the fact that Chris Rogers can't see it, there are a few bits and pieces. Mainly, it's about lacquer. And I know people get excited when they talk about lacquer on a cricket ball. So you've got a kookaburra. It's made of leather. It's got a bit of cork in the middle. It's got twine tied really tightly around it. Then they put the two halves together. Then they stitch them by hand. I've been down there and watched them do it. It's a remarkable process. So, you know, they're still hand-stitched. The test balls are still hand-stitched. But so much of how a cricket ball behaves is down to the level of lacquer on it, whether you need to wear the lacquer off, like with a Duke's ball, or whether it's better with the lacquer on, like a kookaburra, tends to be with the red ball. But because it's got that pink colouring, you can't dye the leather and have it as deeply impregnated with the ink as you can when you put red ink into leather. It's more of a sheen finish that's put on top of the leather, and it doesn't permeate the leather in the same way. So you need more lacquer to protect that ball, which means it can swing more initially in those earlier stages, and it might retain a level of swing later into an innings, particularly once you hit an evening session where it's a bit harder to pick up the trajectory out of the hand. I imagine it's a different neurological process really for a batter to try to pick up that pink ball at night.
Right.
And as the atmospheric conditions can change and breezes come in through sunset, you know, crepuscular weather activity, that can also affect the behavior of the ball. So there's a fair bit going on.
Yeah, and dusk is the problem, Emma. It's like sharks, isn't it? You just don't go swimming at dusk, and you don't face the pink ball at dusk. These are the two lessons.
Exactly. And from what I understand, there's something about the way the lights reflect off it, I understand, is an issue. And then also Alistair Cook has said you can't really make out the seam. That's the thing that's the hardest to make out as it's coming towards you. And that's the thing that, you know, you're looking for to give you a little bit of a clue about what the bowler's bowling. And, it's very interesting, isn't it? Cause Steve Smith is going to wear these eye blacks like Shivnarine Chanderpaul wore. And I think that is to stop this dazzle, right? To stop the dazzle that's going to come from the lights. And I don't think Steve Smith's worn them before. This is a new thing for him.
It has to be said that, like, in the annals of Steve Smith's idiosyncrasies, this isn't even on the podium of strange things that he does. And as we said before, you know, if he makes runs, it will be seen as a masterstroke. And if he doesn't make runs, we will say that his eyes were literally painted on. I've since heard that there's been a Mythbusters episode about the efficacy of these eye blacks, and that there's some evidence it does help you distinguish light and dark. And then that's given way to Manus Labuschagne talking about placebo effects. Greg Chappell's writing articles about 1,000 lux light or something. It allows those of us of a certain disposition to just start talking about the real strangeness and vagaries of cricket. So I'm very much here for it.
Can someone just explain, because there'll be lots of people listening going, I still don't know what they are. What are they? Just two sort of stickers under your eyes.
Black stickers that sit right on your cheekbone. Uh-huh. I mean, if you were talking about makeup, you would say they would go where you'd put highlighter. So not where the blusher goes, because the blusher goes on the cheeks. The apples of your cheeks.
Right.
But if you were putting on highlighter, you would put it just sort of below where your eye bags are, if you have eye bags, which some of us do.
I do.
And that's where they sort of sit.
Right.
The idea is that black absorbs light. Light doesn't reflect off black surfaces. It's absorbed by it. So the light that's bouncing into your face, reflected off the ground, doesn't reflect sort of into your eyes or across the surface of the eye. And it reduces the amount of glare that might interfere with your vision. That's the theory.
Right. So, Sam, does it matter? Because I heard Alistair Cook was saying that you can actually see the ball, right? It's pink and there's bright lights, but you can't see the seam. It always amazes me that when Mitchell Starc's bowling, anyone's got time to see what the seam is doing.
Yeah, I think you've got to really, as an average person, you have to really detect the subtext of this conversation among, like, former players, where what they're really wanting you to understand is that they can see the seam when the ball's delivered to them. I've played cricket. I've never seen the seam. It's just a blur of a thing coming towards me. You hear this with tennis players talking about seeing the writing on the ball, or people talking about the silver of the kookaburra. None of us have seen that. This is just a way for ex-players to show the superiority of their eyesight.
Right.
I can't see the seam here. I can see it there. Anyone pretending that they can be part of that conversation and they weren't a professional cricketer is lying. I don't know.
But does it really matter when you bat? There are tactics, obviously, we saw that with that Stokes declaration in that game. Like, is it really important, the toss and everything?
It can be. It depends on the game. And I mean, I think I've been at all of the pink ball games that Australia have played, and they've played out in some wildly different ways. Joe Root's comments the other day were that it was easier to see the seam because it was a black seam on pink, but maybe that's during the daytime, not so much in the evening. So there have been pink ball tests when the evening is really challenging and a player really has to grind, like Usman Khawaja against South Africa at Adelaide Oval back in, what's it, 2016 now, where he had to play really, really cautious innings through a couple of evening sessions. There have been games where the evening session's been relatively easy to score. That Pakistan game, I think everybody from number 8 to 11 made their highest test score, and a bunch of that was through an evening session, and that wasn't a problem for them. Jamaica, not long ago, as soon as the sun went down, it was absolute carnage. There were 83 wickets would fall in the evening session of that test match against West Indies, even though they got bowled out for 27 in daylight once they resumed on the final morning of the test. So it is all over the place. I think anybody who's too effusive about you have to do this or you have to do that in a pink ball test match, they're also lying. So a lot of lying goes on when people talk about cricket.
Are you calling Stuart Broad a liar? You're calling Stuart Broad a liar because he's very adamant, isn't he? He's absolutely adamant. You've got to.
Yeah. Has he played in all of the test matches that Australia have played in pink ball cricket? He's played in a couple of them, but the one that I can recall is, Joss Butler batted very deep into the game during the Adelaide test the last time on the last tour when they played a couple of pink ball games. And then Hobart was much more of a destruction derby sort of situation with that pink ball and was over in a couple of days, but that's also because England were mentally shot at that point, and Sam Billings arrived to find this absolute wasteland of a dressing room where everybody had already given up while he was trying to celebrate winning his first test cap. So there's a wide variance.
I definitely think that the idea that, and I think this is kind of the Stuart Broad method, is like you control when you bowl. I don't understand how that's a strategy, because for a start, it's absolutely dependent on you winning the toss. And then it's dependent on you batting well. And I just don't understand this whole like control when you bowl. There's no sort of, yes, England have done it once very effectively at Mount Maunganui. They sort of scored a run a minute, didn't they? And then they had the ball in hand, both sessions in twilight and Broad ran through them on the penultimate evening. But that's not really a strategy for test cricket.
It brings an extra element into the match, which is that it puts batting time back on the table as something that actually matters. Whereas with this England side, the way they've always approached it, time, irrelevant, screw it. We don't worry about time. We worry about runs. We score them as quickly as possible. Then we get back on the field and wonder why our bowlers are knackered. That's been the England approach to test cricket for the last 3 years, is one of repeated confusion at the same problem occurring. But batting time is something else. And this is a situation where you're incentivized to go, well, it doesn't actually matter how many you score in, say, the middle session of the day, but if you can bat through it, if you can just make sure that you occupy through that period and you're coming out with the new ball during that evening session, or even sort of coming in later in an evening session, so maybe you've got an hour with a new ball at night and then you've still got a newish ball in the morning, those kind of considerations can come into it and actually can make the game more interesting because there's more tactical stuff at play.
And it also makes it curious that people keep saying about it, you know, players who are both in this series and have played in these games past keep saying, oh, it's not traditional test cricket. Oh, it's not like playing traditional test cricket. Whereas what you've described is like very old school test cricket. Yeah.
Can I ask about, we just talked about occupying time and occupying the crease. I've been interested in all the noise, Sam, that there hasn't been enough chat about the difference between how England bowled in their first innings and their second innings. Because when it was 205 to win, I thought, well, if England bowl like they did in the first innings, they haven't bowled for very long. This is on. I was there going, this is on. You know, who cares about Travis Head? And then it wasn't just one bowler's pace. The pace of every single bowler was down. And so clearly, if you're England, surely you go, we have to occupy the crease so our bowlers have a bit more time. Even if they didn't bowl for very long, they just weren't ready to bowl again, unless they only had one innings in them for the whole series, in which case it's kind of moot.
Yeah, it was a really curious one, and I just want to back that up as well. A lot of people are wise after the fact, but at that innings break, in the press box, there were several people of serious test match experience saying words to me to the effect of England have 40 too many, having just witnessed what they produced in the first innings. And it wasn't just what England had produced in the first innings. It was also a decent memory of what Australia's top order has looked like for several years. You know, starting on the back foot, literally and figuratively, with Usman Khawaja being strangled, blokes in the middle order in far too early, and a lot of question marks over the form of guys. I mean, before Travis Head did what he did, you know, there was lots of column inches given to his most recent scores over the last little while in all formats. So against that backdrop, 200 looked okay. I don't think people were saying at the time, everybody knows that tee time on day two is the best time to bat. All right, we do know that historically, but given the way the game was going, it sure looked like England were going to get the job done, or at least it was going to be really close and it was going to be done that night. Yeah, look, I would take more from what they produced in the first innings than the second.
Sure. And to Australia then, you know, we sort of mentioned Travis Head and Usman Khawaja. Interestingly, you know, the ICC gave the Perth pitch its highest rating and then Khawaja called it a piece of shit, Jeff. Who opens for Australia?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that the guy couldn't make a run there the last couple of years, didn't like the pitch, while everybody else thought it was pretty good. That's just an interesting divergence of views, and people can read into that as they will. He's not shy about a comment here or there. But in terms of what they're doing, I mean, he's in the squad. It's the same as the Weatherald situation before the series. If he's in the squad, he's playing. There's no reason they pick him in the squad and not have him play unless he is walking up the stairs on the morning of and his back goes again, which has to be a concern. There has to be a possibility, right, that as soon as he's under the pressure of a match itself, that injury could recur. But I think if they were worried about that, they wouldn't have picked him in the squad to begin with. They would have just put any speculation to bed. Khawaja's there, he'll open, Head will bat where he normally bats, and any other changes will be situation dependent.
Which feels to me, Emma, like I'd rather Khawaja was there. I mean, I know it's such recency bias, right? It's just what I've just seen Travis Head do, but you feel like you've got Khawaja's number.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, it wasn't just about the batting, was it? It was about the drop slip catches and him looking really miserable. You know, you want the guy who's kind of looking really miserable in the team. It's really interesting. You said at the start, you know, it really felt like a lost opportunity. And of course, that is exactly what it felt like in that first test. And it was. Cummins is out. Josh Hazlewood is out. Khawaja is completely off form. There's an England five-man pace attack firing as it's never fired before. And now going into this second test, we look at it and we go, well, that was a real lost opportunity because obviously now we don't have Mark Wood and et cetera, et cetera. And Head's batted himself back into form. But the fact is there's still quite a lot of those things that were the gift horse in the first place. No Cummins, no Hazlewood, a slightly ropey looking Khawaja. Those gift horses have been given back to us again, you know, so England just cannot.
It's hope.
Yeah, England can't waste that opportunity twice. I don't know. I do sound like a mad person right now.
You need it. You need to take that optimism and with that possibility. Mm. I think if you looked at the start of the series and you said if England could come out of Brisbane Perth at 1-1 somehow, that would be a tremendous victory. Like to get through the two least likely venues for them to get a result. And in a way, they kind of have to win one of those in order to be in the series, right? So because they're not going to draw anything, they've got to win one of those first two. So they've still got the opportunity to win one of the first two and then to tell everybody that we're idiots, they're geniuses, and stick it up, everybody.
And they love to do the unexpected. I mean, this is their whole shtick, is do the unexpected. And actually, the more unexpected thing is to win in Brisbane. That would be the more unexpected thing than to win in Perth.
Yeah, I mean, we say they have to win one of these first two, and it feels, Sam, like it has to be this one. You know, it feels like Perth has gone now. And Emma says that you can't give up these gift horses twice, but the thing is, you can, can't you, Sam?
They can lose this game and still win. That's just mathematical, really. And I do think that the way that they play makes that more possible than in other times, than in times gone by. But yeah, if they win this game, they're more likely to win the series. I mean, the Khawaja thing's super interesting. The contrast between the way he is presenting himself with Travis Head makes his inclusion all the more stark. This is a guy that has probably spent the last 3 to 5 years explicating at any opportunity of how difficult it is to bat atop the order in the Australian team, that there's double lacquer on the ball, that there's more live grass. The data does support that it is harder to do, right? So, like, don't get me wrong, but most of his utterances are about how hard it is and that you don't understand how difficult it is. For this to be the guy that then walks off the field with his hand on the small of his back, you know, limping with an L5-S1 disc issue, and then his successor, whose only public utterances is to say, I'll just do what's best for the team, to come out and blitz it with 120 off 80, does make that contrast really stark. For Australia to then say, we're going to stick with what we do. We're not going to self-select a scalp. You know, we're not going to retire somebody. Just goes to show how much they value that calmness and composure and not bending to drama at the time, even though it appears as though a solution to Australia's top order issues is literally staring them in the face. And the fact that Travis Head is saying now, or as he previously didn't do this, Head is saying now, I'm happy to do it. Australia's risking a test match to basically give Khawaja procedural fairness. And I don't think you'll find many people seeing him as a guy that can influence the series materially. So now that I've said that, I look forward to his 100 at the Gabba.
Yeah, well, procedural fairness and drainage are the two things that we really care about. But before we wrap up, Jeff, anything else we need to... Look, I'm waiting for the applause when Zach Crawley gets a run. It may not happen in this test, but, you know, hopefully by Melbourne.
It'd be great on a packed Boxing Day test, you know, fourth test of the series. He finally nudges one off the hip and gets down the other end. It'll be... No, I might be one of the, I don't know, five or six remaining... I wouldn't say Crawley... backers necessarily, because I'm not brimming with confidence that he will do something, but it's a bit like post-apocalyptic. There's a bunch of billionaires in a bunker in New Zealand. There's a handful of us left going, well, things could work out. You know, I mean, climate change might still be a myth. New York City's underwater, but maybe it's just a natural confluence of events and we didn't actually have much to do with it. Let's just stay here for the next 800 years. I want it to happen because it was such an outrageous and ridiculous thing to keep picking him in this team for like the last 3 years without ever making any runs, purely because he made 80-odd at the SCG 4 years ago. That's the reason. That's why he's still here, because they're like, well, we think he can do it in Australia. We think when it's quick and bouncy and he's facing better quality fast bowlers, he can smash them. At one point in the series, one innings, he'll be able to do it and he'll win us a game. So I want to see the experiment live through to its logical conclusion. He's got to play all five. He's got to get back to Sydney. I hope he makes a ton in the second innings at Sydney in a game that's already gone, and then they have to pick him for four more years. Like, it's just too interesting to give up now. We can't give up now. We cannot give up on the experiment now. We've all invested. We're all in. Give him the 10 innings. Don't rob us of this delight. Let's see.
It's like Dragon's Den when they say, and how much of your own money have you invested in this business? And they say £25 million of Peter Jones. It's like this going, oh, no, Zach Crawley's a lifestyle business. Really, get out while you can. Yeah. Okay, Sam, what's going to happen, please? What's your prediction? I mean, it's obviously a stupid question. It's very hard to know.
I think England will try and refine slightly, but their compulsivity will still bring them undone eventually. I think Australia has wily, experienced players who will ultimately prevail with a little bit of extra knowledge about playing in these pink decks. And, but you know, we'll see some rays of light from England, but not enough.
Emma?
I think it's going to be a weird test, and England are going to do weird things, and then they're going to win it in a weird way. This is where I'm at. I'm kind of a little bit at this point, like, you know how they have this habit of winning tests in this kind of like very, we call them heists, you know, in this very Ocean's 11 way. Like, they look like they've given it away. They declare at ridiculous points. They seem to lose wickets on purpose. Well, I'm just telling myself that this first test is all just part of the plan. That losing it, that was part of the plan. It's Ocean's 11. You make it look like everything's gone wrong, but actually, secretly, you're doing your burglary behind the scenes.
We're lulling you, Jeff. What do you reckon? Last word to you.
Yeah. Oh, I love this. I love this idea that this has all been a hoax. Look over here. Look who actually we've broken into the vault of runs that's under Brisbane, the 60 stories underneath Brisbane City. We've been stealing all of the runs from Brisbane in the meantime. England are going to get a start at none for 402 first ball. Like, this is an incredible plan. I'm looking forward to it.
All right, guys. Well, look, thanks for your time. Let's see what happens. We'll be back after the test. Maybe 2 days, maybe three, maybe certainly not five. Let's not be silly, guys. But look out for the drainage. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Emma.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Max. Thanks, everyone.
If you want more from Sam and Ian Higgins, listen to The Great Cricketer. When you're not listening to The Guardian Ashes Weekly, of course. Cheers, Jeff.
Thank you. Yes, it's going to be 5 days. We'll have a few little rain showers in there. Come on, we're going to get to day five. Let's do it.
Okay, if you want to get in touch, ashes.weekly at theguardian.com. You can find us on YouTube, follow Guardian Sport on Instagram and TikTok. Ashes Weekly is produced by Nick Harmon. Our executive producer is Daniel Simo. The theme tune is by Rudy Zigablo. Back after the second test.
This is The Guardian.